coming at you today with the story of a high value financial advisor. Hey, what's up, party people? It's me, Sarah G with the Smack, and I'm back. I am a CFA charter holder, and I used to be a financial advisor. On this podcast, I provide non-BS oriented, straight up views on LinkedIn and other financial advisor marketing topics. You can't get this anywhere else, people. So if that's of value, then please subscribe. And if not, then please leave this podcast right now. The other day, it hit me that the only systems in America, other than AUM, where you pay more for making more, are alimony, child support, and the IRS. So the point of this podcast is not to debate about which fee model, but instead I'd rather talk about how do we provide higher value to clients. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about how to provide high value. And the person I have here today is an hourly financial planner. So my goal is to learn about this from someone who does this exceptionally well. Today, I have Rick Ferry with me, who is an hourly advisor, a CFA charter holder, and the host of the Boggleheads podcast, which has over 1 million views. And we're going to talk about how to provide high value as an hourly financial planner. Rick, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Sarah. I appreciate you having me on today.
So did I get that right about your podcast? You have over 1 million views. I saw something about that on social media.
I do. I started the Bogleheads on Investing podcast back in, about 3 years ago, a little over 3 years ago now. And my first guest was Jack Bogle, and that was a few months before he passed away. And then I do a new guest every month. And the podcast is sponsored by the John C. Bogle Center for Financial Literacy, which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. I happen to be the president of that right now. And we have a lot of things going on with the Bogleheads, including a conference coming up in Chicago next October. And it's all nonprofit. So it's no one makes any money from it. And it's just to try to spread the word about getting your fair shake on Wall Street.
Tally ho. Yes. Well, that is great. So how did the podcast, I'm just going to ask you about this because I know a lot of advisors out there are trying to do the same thing. They're starting podcasts or they're trying to kind of get the word out and get more visibility. What do you feel has allowed you to get an astounding amount of visibility in just 3 years?
Well, I think the Bogleheads name carries a lot of weight. I've been involved in that organization for 20 years. I've written a lot of books. So I'm very kind of known in that organization, and then now I'm the president of the John C. Bogle, the Bogle Center, we call it. So I think that had a lot to do with getting people to begin to listening to the podcast. But I better tell you that I think the first one I did, and I did it with Jack Bogle, I maybe had 5,000 downloads, and that was Jack Bogle. And so now we're getting 35,000 downloads a month. And it's increasing every month. So it just takes time. It's the slow build. If you would look at my listens over the last 3.5 years, it's just a very steady, slow climb of putting out what I think is quality content and adding, only doing one a month. I think that with podcasts, the more you do, of course, the faster it'll ramp up. If you're doing one a week, it ramps up a lot faster. But I'd only had time to do one a month because I do everything from start to finish. I don't have any editors or anything. I mean, I literally pick the guest, I do the recording, I do the editing, I do the marketing, I do everything, front to back. And I pay for all of it myself, as a matter of fact, because it's, again, all nonprofit. So it just takes time. And, you have to put out good content and you have to have good editing. And it'll build slowly.
Yeah.
Like everything else in this business, it's continuous. It has to be continuous. People have to anticipate that once a month or once a week, you're going to do a podcast and they're going to know the quality of the guests and know the quality of the recording. And it just takes time.
Mm-hmm. And so also, I was reading that you were in the Marines, that you were a fighter pilot.
I was. Wow. So when I got out of college, I graduated from the University of Rhode Island with a degree in business back in 1980. And back then, there was the worst recession you could possibly imagine. The unemployment rate was somewhere around 15%. Interest rates were sky high. Inflation was higher. And there was no jobs.
Don't scare me with that, right?
You couldn't get a job at a shoe store, I mean, literally. But I ended up, I had always had an interest in the military anyway. I was an Eagle Scout back in the day when I was in Boy Scouts and so forth. So I always had an interest in the military. So what I did was I joined the Marines, and they sent me to flight school, and I had never flown before, so that was interesting, and did pretty well and got selected for advanced jet training. And next thing you know, I'm getting my wings. It took about 2 years from the time I went in the Marine Corps until the time I got my wings. In fact, I'm wearing them today. And right. That was the Navy wings, because Marines go to Navy flight school. And I was, I flew fighters for about 6 years. And then I went into the reserves for about 13 years and ended up retiring in 2000.
Well, thank you for your service. And just one thing I'm curious about, how much do they train you before they have you fly the plane?
Well, there's a lot of steps to it. I think that they first go through all of the testing. It's psychological testing. It's obviously medical. And there's a whole lot of testing before they even let you get into an airplane. And then you have to go through a whole battery of education. They have all of these modules that you do on aviation and weather and flight rules and all kinds of stuff. And it's just one after another after another. And you have to pass all of these things. And then they start training you. It takes about, well, in the Marines, it's a little bit longer because we have to go to two different schools as a Marine before we end up going to flight school. So it probably took me, before I actually got in an airplane, almost a year of being in the military, in the Marine Corps. And then flight school itself was total. There was three different phases of it, but it was probably, I'd say about a year and a half long. Before they turn over the keys and give you your wings and say, here's a jet, go fly.
Well, one of the reasons I'm curious about that, and by the way, for those who have been following this podcast for a while or following my writings, you may know that I'm deathly scared of heights. Like when I go to an airport, I have to just talk to anybody I see to take my mind off of the fact that I'm about to get on a plane, and I'm like crazy. I'm crazy. But so the reason that I'm talking about this, because to be a pilot, that takes such a high degree of skill. And it's kind of rare that you see someone that is, successful pilot and has done this. And that's really what we're going to talk about today, is skill, having skill as a financial advisor, because from my observation in the industry, what I've seen is that throughout its history, value has not often been tied to the skill of the advisor, but instead it's been linked to a lot of times the AUM or the performance or the products that the advisor sells. And I'm seeing that there's a little bit of a delinking that's happening, where with more technology and more accessibility to information, investors and clients are wanting more. And so that's really the heart of what we're going to talk about today, is how do you deliver value as an advisor? Because I think this is something that a lot of advisors have a problem articulating, is what is the value that I deliver? So, so Rick, you're an hourly advisor.
Now, yes.
Okay. But before you were, tell me about your history.
Well, in 1988, when I left active duty in the Marines, I went to work as a broker for Kidder Peabody, which was a kind of a boutique brokerage firm back in the day, a very quality company. And, back then in the 1980s, brokers were...
That's what it was.
That's what it was. I mean, you To me, I didn't know, but I thought that brokers were analysts that analyzed investments and make good investment decisions for their clients, and the clients do well, and the firm does well, and then me as the advisor, the broker, if you will, does well. And I thought that's what it was all about. And I went to work in the brokerage industry, and you know, you go to broker boot camp, that's what they called it back then. And it was a little bit of what you see on the movies, you know, the Wolf of Wall Street, the movie Wall Street. You know, it was a hardcore sales. You know, you would use lines like, well, you try to sell somebody in the very first phone call. I mean, you were trying to sell them 1,000 shares of stock and, you know, 2,000 shares of whatever the company was pushing at the time. And this didn't seem to me to be, I don't know, it was a little odd for me, because I thought, well, where's the research? I mean, how, you know, aren't we supposed to be, you know, digging into balance sheets and income statements and you know, asking clients a lot of questions about their background? And the answer was no, you're supposed to sell them what the firm wants you to sell. Well, I ended up using, instead of me going out and doing that, I managed the client's fixed income portfolios and corporate bonds, municipal bonds. So I would actually build bond ladders for the clients, but then I'd use money managers, stock money managers, to go out and put together stock portfolios for the clients. And these stock money managers all had something called the Chartered Financial Analyst Charter. And so I said, I should get that. So I did. I went out and I took the three exams and I passed, and I became a Chartered Financial Analyst Charter. But then I went on
and CFA designation.
CFA designation, correct.
Yeah.
So I did that early in the 1990s so that I had some understanding of portfolio management. After all, I was in the investment industry. It seemed to me I should have some understanding. And it was odd that the firm that I worked for, Kidder Peabody, didn't require any training at all, except, you know, what they wanted you to have. And so I went out on my own and I did this. And then I switched firms and went to Smith Barney after 5 years. Kidder sort of broke up and was sold off in pieces, and went to Smith Barney. And at Smith Barney, when I finished my Chartered Financial Analyst designation, they designated me as a portfolio manager. But then I went and got my Master's of Science in Finance, where I continued to study and started getting into active management versus passive management and indexing and so forth and benchmarking and a lot of different things.
But Rick, at this point, are you... I mean, you have an established book by this point.
I do. I have an established book. I've gained clientele. I happen to do well with people who were very interested in investing. I mean, they weren't just turning their money over to people. They really were very interested in investing. And I was going through all of this, so I sort of connected very well with the people who were very interested in getting into the weeds of, you know, analysis and, you know, active.
That's funny, because
most
financial
so
advisors
forth.
Can't stand clients like that.
Well, it's our job.
Were they engineers? were they engineers and attorneys?
A lot of engineers, a lot of, you know, physicians, business owners, and you know, they were just more in tune with what was going on, if you will.
Yeah.
So, okay.
So you're
that's how I
making their money. You have a full blown practice at this point. You're not just selling on the phones anymore.
No. Okay. No, that's correct. I was managing their money at this
still,
point.
Like, are you hybrid? Are you AUM and commission?
Well, I was half and half, because the brokerage, the bond side was commission. I was just rolling bonds. They were, you know, I build a bond ladder and then just roll the bonds when they matured. So that was a commission business. And then on the equity side, I was using money managers, and that
mutual funds.
I'm sorry.
Mutual funds or.
No, it was actually individual securities. So separately managed accounts.
Like SMA manager.
Yeah, correct. They didn't call them SMAs back then, but they were separately managed accounts. Same thing. And they used to wonder what was called a wrap fee. And you'll be taken back a little bit, but the fees on these things were 3%. Now, that was pretty high. I didn't charge 3%, but we could discount it down to 2.25. So if you can imagine, that was a high AUM fee. But that's what it was. It was an AUM fee. And what I did, though, was I really monitored very, very closely the performance of these advisors and these managers, and realized that very few of them were even coming close to the performance of the benchmark. And I would create the benchmark. I mean, I got very much into benchmarking and indexing and index you know, indexes as benchmarks, bond indexes, stock indexes, international index. I was very much into that. And so I was looking at these managers and comparing them. The value and growth indexes came out during this period of time. So I was using them to do analysis to see whether or not they were outperforming the index that I chose. And they weren't. They were significantly underperforming by a lot. It was a lot. And this is where I, in 1996, discovered Jack Bogle and Vanguard and index funds. I had my epiphany, my aha moment. And I said, look, these managers can't do it. They're not doing it. They're not outperforming. I'm just going to start using index funds, which didn't go very well with the brokerage model at the time, because there was no money in it to do that.
There was no money in it.
No, there was no money in it. I was using what I could, which were SPY, the S&P 500 Spider, and MDY, the S&P 400 Midcap. And those were the only two exchange-traded funds that I had available. But at working in a brokerage firm, you didn't have access to anything else. You didn't have access to Vanguard funds or index funds, because they wouldn't pay the brokerage company marketing fees, and they wouldn't pay 12b1 fees. I mean, Vanguard wasn't going to do it, so we had no access. And that's when I made the decision and to leave the brokerage industry and start my own RIA, and that was in 1999. So I did. I left and started my own RIA at the time.
What was the response from your clients when you said that?
Oh, positive. I mean, again, they would have been following me and, you know, kind of watching me as I've been going through this evolution over about a 10-year period of time. And they were very much up to speed on, you know, where I was going and why I was going there. And they all, when you move from the brokerage industry to start your own RIA, about 80% of the clients will go with you. 80%. This is if you have a relationship with them. And it's sort of the same thing if you go from one brokerage firm to another, about 80% move with you. So I had done one move from one company to another, and 80% of the clients, 80% of the assets came with me. I should say 80% of the assets, not so much the clients, because you tend to leave a lot of the little clients behind and you take the bigger clients. That's what you do. And when I left the brokerage industry and became an RIA, I took 80% of the assets with me and moved them over to Charles Schwab, which was my custodian, and started doing a low fee advisory shop. Now it was low fee, it was very
using
different.
Using Vanguard funds.
Using Vanguard and using, at that time, Dimensional Fund Advisors, some of their funds and a few things that looked like index funds, but maybe weren't index funds. But my fee that I charged them was only 0.25%. So I was charging 1/4 the typical 1% management fee. Why?
1/4, so that's a huge delta from what your clients were being charged.
Yep.
When you were back at Solomon.
Sure. So they immediately got, just from that, they immediately got about a 1.5%, you know, better return on their portfolios. But why did I get the 0.25% fee from? Well, it came from the mutual fund industry, where they, if you put $1 million, say, with American funds, as a fund company, you take a client's $1 million IRA rollover and you put it into American funds and you divide it up between the Euro-Pacific Fund, Growth Fund of America, and so forth. It's $1 million all going to that one fund company, so you don't get a commission on that. The clients aren't charged a commission to get in, a front-end load, but you do get a trailing 12b1 fee. That's how you get paid. So on $1 million, you get paid $2,500 a year, which was 25 basis points. And this is where I came up with the 25.25% fee, only I wasn't using American funds, I was using index funds. And that's how I came up with that fee. And it worked very well, actually. It was very successful. So it was really the first very low AUM fee RIA in existence at the time. Yeah.
Okay, so what happens after that? So this is like the late 90s, early 2000s.
Correct.
That you started your own firm. Okay. So now we're in 2022. How did we get, what's happened over the last 20 years?
Well, we grew very rapidly, and I grew. It was just me working out of my living room, much like I'm doing now. And we grew very rapidly. I say we because I had to bring on a junior partner, and we expanded to about $1.5 billion. I was then in the process of selling out to this junior partner, and we ran into some legal problems, him and I. And we ended up, I ended up buying him out, and then I got bought out by a private equity investor right after that. So it was boom, boom, two transactions. And that was it. I was ready to leave the AUM industry, though. I was kind of almost beyond that in a way. There were so many good things coming out, like Vanguard had come out with their PAS program that was only charging 0.3%. Betterment had come out with a 0.25% program. Wealthfront was out there. So a lot of other people were doing low fee management now. It sort of started to pick up steam. And I was ready to step away from the AUM model and do more advising. Because when you're an AUM manager, you're not advising. You're thinking, gather assets, gather assets, gather assets. I mean, that's what you're thinking. And, you know, get these assets invested and charge the fee and then go to the next person and do the same thing and go to the next person, do the same thing. I mean, it's all your number. How much are you managing, right? I mean, that's what it was all about with AUM. It wasn't about actually advising people. And so I was really getting
that's
a little
the narrative even now in the industry.
No, it's true. I mean, I've been on all sides of this,
right?
So it's
how
true.
How much AUM do you have?
So when I left, I had a non-compete, and then when the non-compete was over with, I said, now I'm going to go back to doing what I think I'm good at. Well, I thought I was good at managing money and all of that, and everybody did well because the fees were low. Like Jack Bogle always says, cost matter, and that's true, and the advisor side as well, but when you're managing money. So I decided I was just going to do an hourly model. I've been friends with Cheryl Garrett for many, many years, and I was very interested in her model with Garrett Financial Planners. And I'm not a financial planner, by the way, but I do a lot of financial planning, even though I'm not a financial planner. I do a lot with clients with investing, taxes, retirement planning. But when it comes to some of the other things like, you know, health insurance or estate planning, I'm not that good at that. And I'll do a little bit about that, but basically I tell them they need to speak to an estate planning attorney, or on the insurance side, they would need to speak to somebody who is more knowledgeable about healthcare insurance and so forth. So there's certain parts of financial planning that I don't get involved in. But if you're talking about taxes, you're talking about investing, retirement planning, I mean, I'm all very, very good at that. Integrating Social Security, you know, Medicare, IRMA, and all of these things that go along with retirement, I'm very good at. So this is what I work with clients on, and I get paid by the hour. Yeah.
So you're saying that Cheryl Garrett influenced you?
Yes.
Kind of in that direction.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Because
yeah, I've known Cheryl for many. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I mean, to my knowledge, there aren't a ton of hourly advisors out there.
There are not. There are not. And our hope, I say our hope, because there are a few and they're growing. Our hope is that there are more advisors realize that this is really a viable business. You could make just as much money as an advisor doing just advising than you can managing money. And it's hard to step out of the money management role, you know, give that up, turn it over to somebody else, if you will, and just become an advisor. But it's much more rewarding, I think, because now as soon as you do that, lifted. In other words, there's a lifting, if you will, of the pressure on you to build AUM. And you could actually, you listen to yourself talk to these clients now as an hourly advisor, and you're saying things that you probably would have never said as an AUM advisor, because your focus on AUM was to build AUM. Your focus now is on what does the client need and what should we be doing to help the client, and no matter where it takes you. This is what your focus is. You're not trying to move money from UBS over to Vanguard, or I mean UBS over to Schwab or Fidelity, so that you can manage it. That's no longer the focus. The focus now is I don't really care where you have your money. Let's do what you should be doing with it. And you know, I'm not My compensation is not based on a product anymore. It's based on advice. So it's different, very different.
So do you have
go ahead.
Discretion on the accounts?
No, not at all. No, I talk with the clients. They send me all their statements. I do an analysis for them. Then I get on the phone with them. We talk for a couple of hours. This is a new client. I call this a portfolio second opinion. At the end of that 2-hour call, after we go over everything, I might spend the first hour and a half talking with them about their goals, their family, estate planning, taxes, Social Security, Medicare, healthcare, you know, how they're going to pay for healthcare, the types of accounts that they have. I mean, distributions from retirement. And then actually the last 30 minutes as we're talking about the investments in the portfolio. But at the end of that 2-hour call, I'll write up a letter. It might be 3, 4, 5 pages long on all the things that we talked about and all the recommendations that I had. And then I send that to them and I get paid $995 for that, $995 flat fee for that. And then that's it, pretty much done. If they implement it on their own, if they have questions, they can email me and I just answer them, you know, as needed. I don't charge for that. If in a year or two or three, they want to come back for a checkup or they have more questions, I just charge an hourly fee for that. And I charge $450 an hour. And I'd say maybe after a year or two or three, maybe 20% come back. I imagine I've been doing this for 3 years. I imagine as I, you know, move along, maybe half the people will come back for a checkup. But, you know, quite frankly, after I'm done with that portfolio second opinion, that's it. I mean, it's a one-time package deal and there's no obligation. I don't run a dentist chair where I'm trying to schedule them, you know, a year in advance or 6 months. I don't do anything like that. If they want the help, they just get back on my schedule and I'll get up to speed by reviewing everything that I have in my files on them. And then I get back on the phone with them and talk with them for maybe only be 30 minutes, might be 45, might be an hour. You know, I prorate that hour fee. So, but I stay pretty busy. So I do one new client a day, and then I do generally an hour to an hour and a half of an existing client. And, you know, you look at it and that's $1,500 a day revenue coming in. And you multiply that times 20 days, you're talking $30,000 a month. Let's call it 10 months. That's $300,000 a year. That's very easily done. And it's just all hourly. It's not, there's no AUM in there at all. No product sales.
But how do you get the one new client a day? I mean, you have your podcast.
Oh, well, that's marketing. I mean, all advisors have to market. I mean, marketing is continuous. You can't just hang a shingle out there and they will come. That's not what, you know, you got to be out there. I've written many books. I've written articles. I do the podcast and I'm out there and I've been out there for 25 years. And so I've built up a following and people have come and that's how I get my clients. But I have to tell you, even people who are new to this, who are just kind of getting started, they're building a clientele. I helped a fellow by the name of John Luskin get started last year and he's building, you know, he's building up a clientele. He's staying busy. He's booking clients. You know, it's not as much as I am, but he'll get there. And there are other people as well who are just all booked up. I mean, it's very hard to find somebody who has the time to work with it, but there's a real shortage of people like myself and John and other folks out there who are doing this. I mean, pretty much difficult to get on somebody's schedule. It really is. I'm booked up for these portfolio second opinions all the way to the end of the summer. And I have about 100 people on a waiting list for at the end of the summer. When I open up my calendar for the fall, I have about 100 people on the waiting list already. So I'm going to be booked up as soon as I open up my calendar at the end of the summer for the fall. I'll be booked up through December for the whole year. I mean, I could literally book up for the whole year right now if I opened up the calendar. But imagine that. Imagine being booked up 10 months in advance for these. And that's the way it is. That's how much demand there is for this out there.
Because you are in the small number of advisors who have chosen to structure your practice this way.
Correct. I mean, yes, but the demand is overwhelming. I mean, literally, I can't describe to you how overwhelming the demand is for this service. it's there. But it's difficult for the advisors to accept it and to make this decision that they're going to go this direction. It really, really is. I mean, again, I've been in the business for 35 years now. It's hard. It was hard for me to give up the brokerage industry and start an RIA because they had to give up trailing commissions. And it was quite a bit of trailing commissions that I gave up, but I couldn't do that when I became an AUM-only RIA. I wasn't a dual registered RIA. So I had to give up the trailing commissions. It was difficult to do that. And it was difficult to give up that really nice paycheck from AUM to turn around and start an hourly business from scratch. It's difficult. It is. It's hard to make that decision to do that. But I mean, I've been fortunate. I've been able to do it. And I think others can do it as well. I mean, I get inquiries from advisors all the time saying, what if I wanted to do what you're doing, but right now I'm doing AUM? Well, first you have to find somebody to take over the management of the client's portfolios. And there are money management companies that'll do that. And you could stay as the financial advisor on the account, just advising the client while the other company is actually doing the behind the scenes, you know, portfolio management, but you're not actually doing it anymore.
Rick, that's important. Can we just pause there for a minute? Could you give some examples of such companies?
Well, the fellow that I use used to work for me. His name is Ken Carbow, and it's Liberty Capital Management up in Birmingham. He was my portfolio manager at the company that I had for more than 10 years, and now he went out and he has his own company. He's managing about $500 million. But all he does is portfolio management. They don't do financial planning. They are investment people, portfolio management people.
Some people use
His company. Yeah, his company. And he charges he charges the clients that I send to them, he charges them a quarter of a percent per year management fee, which is what I negotiated for the clients that, you know, I sent to him. But he'll do that for any advisor, pretty much. Or he'll charge a flat fee. In other words, you know, he's...
Flat fee.
A flat fee instead. In other words, if you wanted to do a flat fee instead of doing a... AUM fee.
Yeah.
You know, he would do a flat fee. So I can't speak to what he would charge, but it'd be probably, if you had, you know, $5 million or $6 million, it might be $6,000 or $7,000 or $8,000 a year. I really can't speak to what it would be because that's between the client and...
But that's much less than what it would be.
Oh, sure. It's a lot less because his role in this thing is to manage the investment portfolio. Now, if the client keeps me involved, then, you know, I'll speak with the client also. And if Ken Carbow wants my advice, I charge him also. So in full disclosure, I mean, he has hired me as a advisor to on the investment advisory committee that he has. So he pays me my fee for just advising him. And I have some other advisors out there that are doing that also. But that's one option. There are many other people. I sent a lot of people to Vanguard. I sent a lot of people to PAS because PAS would manage the portfolio.
I don't
really send clients to Betterman, and I like Betterman. I liked it better when John Stein was there, but he's not there anymore. I've got a lot of respect for what John did. Their portfolios are just too complicated for me. They just have too much stuff in their portfolios. And same thing with Wealthfront. I like Andy Radcliffe and what he did over at Wealthfront. Now it's part of UBS, but there's just too much stuff going on in their portfolios. It's too complex. I like simplicity. And so Vanguard is very simple. They're making it more complex now, but they used to use just four funds. So I like that. So I'll send people to PAS and so forth. Betterman, no, not really. It's just too complicated. And I've told them that too, that it's nothing new to those folks. I've told them many times I have this thing, complexity for job security, right? Which means advisors make things, the portfolios too complex because it gives them job security. I don't like that. There's no reason to do that.
Over diversification.
It's not diversification. It's complexity for job security. I mean, when you take I call it the Humpty Dumpty strategy, and it's actually Aaron's last name, but he has a great cartoon out there. I put it up on Twitter. And basically has this picture of Humpty Dumpty getting pushed off a wall by a money manager, and Humpty Dumpty breaks into a bunch of pieces. And then the money manager comes along, glues them all back together, and charges 1% AUM for it. In other words, You see, I mean, you could.
I saw that the other day, actually.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was a great cartoon, wonderful, and it just perfectly captures what's going on in the industry, complexity for job security, and it is you don't need that. I mean, you just need a few good funds, a total stock market U.S., total international, a couple of bond funds. I mean, you really don't need a complex portfolio. You know, Vanguard has this figured out. Vanguard's collecting 30 basis points management fee, and people are getting a very simple portfolio. So it's not the portfolio. It's not the portfolio that people are concerned about. I mean, you don't need to make things complex for clients. You don't need to kind of lock the client into something that when they look at the portfolio, they say, "Oh, there's so many things here, I can't figure this out. I'll just leave it up to you." No, that's not fair. It's not fair to the client. I mean, you know, if it's you don't need to take a U.S. stock market and divide it into growth, value, large cap, small cap, mid cap, you know, and you know, six different funds and break it all apart and then put it back together as a total stock market fund. Just keep it as a total stock market fund. It's much simpler, much more tax efficient, lower cost, less complicated. And clients appreciate that. They're still going to pay you because they want you to tell them what's in their best interest. And doing a simple portfolio is in their best interest. And this whole idea of complexity for the sake of job security is going the wrong direction, in my opinion.
So now, when so you mentioned that you charge, was it 450 an hour, did you say? Forgive
Correct.
me if I've misquoted you.
450 an hour.
Okay. How did you come up with that number?
I asked Alan Roth how much he was charging. Alan Roth is another financial planner, and he said he was charging 450 an hour. And I figured if Alan was charging that, I should be able to get that too.
Right. And then
So I
your
did.
okay, and then your 2 hour. That's a flat fee.
Yeah, so the
Flat rate.
995 was my creation. I looked at it and I said, okay, how long is it going to take me to do one of these portfolio second opinions? And it takes me about 4 hours. So it's a workup of about 30 minutes of looking at all the information and getting it all in a format that I understand, that I can see what the client has and where they have. It takes me about 30 minutes to do that. 2 hour conversation on the phone with a client, and then about an hour and a half after that to write up the letter because all the letters are handwritten. So it's a 4 hour turnover. So I'm getting a really about 250 an hour for that. But that's okay because those are new clients. Now, when they come back, I charge 450 an hour because what I really, it's not really 450 because I have to go back into their stuff and I have to get back up to speed on what we talked about last time, and I don't charge them for any of that time. And then when I get them on the phone, if it's just 30 minutes, then I get 225 for that. You know, so it's really not, it's more like ends up being about 250 an hour is what I really get. So that's really what my fee is if you want to look at from beginning to end with each client, from the paperwork all the way through to, you know, going on to the next thing. It really ends up being about 250 an hour.
This is so interesting. And thank you very much, Rick, because this is something that I've been speaking about, and there's such resistance. But this is going to help me in my future writings on this. One of the things that I think about a lot is the degree to which the industry, in many cases, doesn't handle smaller portfolios appropriately.
Sure.
And because I see often this 1.5% for accounts under $1 million. And if you look at what the impact is on a portfolio, a small portfolio over time of a fee that large, it's astronomically expensive.
Absolutely.
Okay, Rick. So can you tell me about what your typical clients' portfolios tend to look like? Are these larger portfolios? Are they smaller portfolios? It's across the board.
Okay, so I'll give you the range. My smallest portfolio was negative $300,000. Now, why do I say that? Because they were $300,000 in debt. He was coming off, he was in residency of a doctor in residency, but he wanted to, you know, learn to invest the right way and do things the right way right from the start. He had a $300,000 in student loans. He was just getting started with a 403B at the hospital he was working at. He also
Right.
had a 457. Maybe he had $10,000, $11,000 actually invested. So Yeah, I mean, you know, I charged him $9.95, and we did the portfolio second opinion, and now he's got a plan and go forward and with this
Hold
plan.
On, okay, but this is the kind of a scenario, Rick, that financial advisors would say, I don't want anything to do with this person. I can put him on my wait list. I could put him on my mailing list, but I'm not interested in this type of client. And this is, I mean, like what a radiologist earning $300,000 or more a year.
Oh, much right? more radiologist. Yeah.
Radio. Okay.
Yeah. But anyways, I mean, go ahead. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like this sure. is such a great opportunity for the advisors that can do things a little bit differently and not have to have it tied to AUM. I mean, look at what you're missing. Whereas when this person gets out of debt, which is probably going to be in not too long amount of time, right?
Yeah, like a loan forgiveness after 10 years. But, okay. Advisors who put this person on a wait list, well, they might be on your wait list, but that you as the advisor are not on their wait list. I mean, if you're not going to take care of their needs now when they're contacting you, you are out. Boom. You could go ahead and put them on your wait list and send them whatever emails you want every 6 months and contact them every year and say, how much money do you have now? But they're not going to work with you. They're not going to work with you because you rejected them when they needed you. And so it's, you know,
Okay. And you know what else it's for too? The person working at the startup that doesn't have the stock options yet, that it has it, but it hasn't gone public and is broke sure. or whatever, right? Or not that much money. And that's the same thing where they have this joke in Silicon Valley that like when they see people sitting in the lobby with the suits on, they know it's a Wall Street person. You know what I mean? Like it's because there's such a rush when the company finally IPOs. And it's like, well, imagine if 10 years before that, you had been the advisor that they trusted that they're talking to. And then
sure. Yeah. Happens all the time with me. I mean, the people who come back to me, hey, I did sell my company. Hey, we did IPO. You know, what do I do? How do I handle all this new wealth? Sure. It happens all the time. I mean, so by the way, so my smallest client is -$300 million. Largest client is about $100 million. And well, I have several clients that are over $50 million, but it doesn't matter. I mean, I don't get the same amount of I get the same amount of money, so it makes no difference to me whether I'm working with somebody who's got $50 million or 50,000. It doesn't make any difference.
Okay, Rick. So let's talk about the client with $50 million.
Yeah,
that person is working with one of these portfolio management firms that you've referred them to.
No.
Or whoever they're working with.
No, generally they come to me. Either they have been self-managing their portfolio their whole life, or maybe they were working with a Goldman Sachs or somebody like that, or maybe a money management company. But generally, and they have come to the light. You know, they have realized that they're paying way too much, and it's all about. Now, smoke and mirrors in many ways, you know, complexity for the sake of job security and things we went over before. And they've had their epiphany and they're ready now to make a change. And so when they've been doing it themselves and they've already been managing their own portfolios in sort of the Boglehead way, it's more of a validation or a confirmation of what they're doing. And when they come from another advisor and it's this complexity for the sake of job security portfolio, this Humpty Dumpty portfolio that the advisor put together, it's a restructuring. I have to kind of restructure things and make them simpler so that they can manage it. So the idea is, you know, get them to the point, if they're already doing it, just make it just validated and, you know, clean it up a little bit if needed, trim around the edges and so forth. But if they are they just converted and they have this really, really messy portfolio and they always come that way. They're just an absolute mess of stuff. And you got to take that and you got to bring it down to something that they can manage. And sometimes that takes a while for them to be able to do it. But I do turn it up. Now, those people who say, those are the people who will say, I don't really want to do this myself. And then I'll say, okay, well, I can refer you to somebody who can do this for you, but you have to pay them a fee. And here's the names of a few people, you know, who you may want to talk with about doing that. And then I'll give them the names of some people. So depending on what they want to do.
Okay. So a lot of the time when I talk about, so first of all, do you use a time tracking app?
Yeah. It's called an iPhone right here. Basically, when, you know, I make all my calls on my iPhone, I could track the amount of time I'm spending on the phone with them. Like I said, I only, on the hourly stuff, I'm only charging for the amount of time I'm actually speaking with somebody, but I know it's like double that, the amount of time that I actually have to put in. So it's, you know, like I say, I charge $450 an hour for the amount of time I'm actually speaking with them on the phone. But in fact, it's actually twice that amount of time that I put in. And the same thing with the portfolio second opinion. I charge them the $995, but it includes the time beforehand to prepare and then the time afterwards to write the letter. So my time tracking app is just my phone, and I can see to the minute how much time we spent on a call.
So people argue, some advisors will argue, that this makes the client have to pay more costs, have to pay more, that it costs more at the most stressful times of their life. Like when they're getting a divorce or they've had a major life change. And for that reason.
I don't know how. I really don't know how. I don't know how they make that claim. I mean, how? How much time do you need to spend with somebody who's going through this major life change? Maybe they're retiring, selling their business. Maybe they're getting divorced. I mean, how much actual time does the advisor need to speak with them and to help them? What, an hour? Maybe 2 hours? Maybe? That's $1,000?
Okay, so Rick, you're an excellent communicator. You have a podcast. You've been in the business 35 years. You probably have somewhat of an idea of how to handle clients and how to answer questions and a lot of the situations you've heard before, and you know how to handle it. But that might not be the case for somebody that's a little bit less experienced. Like, let's say there's someone been in the business 5 to 10 years, and the client comes to them and says, you know, I'm getting divorced and I don't know how to handle, like how to split this up. Do I need a quadro or this or that? You see what I'm saying? Like, not everyone's as good a communicator. I think that's important, because when you're talking about time and you're talking about charging people for time, I do think the advisor has to be able to be in command of these kinds of situations so that the costs don't get out of control for the client.
Well, that could be true for some advisors, but I do also think that there's a lot of stuff that might happen that isn't really necessary. Let's run a Monte Carlo simulation model and see, you know, where this thing comes out. Let's do an optimization here. Fill out this 100-question questionnaire. An awful lot of stuff that you're right. I mean, because of my experience, I just skip over all that stuff. I don't find it to be useful at all. And let's just get down to the meat of what really is important. But yeah, I mean, you know, if advisors in their career will learn over time what's important and what's not important, I understand. And in that process, they might be spending more time with clients as the advisor learns than they need to. But then again, I don't think that the average advisor is charging $450 an hour either. So, you know, my view.
Right. What do you feel has been the most difficult thing to put this hourly model in place?
Just telling people I'm booked. That's the most difficult thing. I can't get to you, Sarah. I really like to work with you, but I really can't put you on my calendar until November. So you got April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November. 8 months from now is when I can talk with you. I'm sorry, but I apologize, but I'm just booked. That's the hardest thing for me.
Yeah. Okay, Rick. So thank you so much. I realize we've gone over on the time here, but this to me is such
sorry about the banging in the background. I got some people working here.
Well, that's okay. You know, I have 4 kids, right? So I'm here today, but they're always my podcast. Okay, Rick, what advice would you give to a 30-year veteran in the business, but someone that maybe is either starting out or is maybe like I would say early to middle stage financial advisor that wants to transition to this model or wants to start a practice with this model,
yeah.
What would you say to that person?
It's scary. It really is. I mean, to make this transition, it's hard. Now, I think that a lot of advisors who are really truly advisors, that truly want to be an advisor. That's what they want to do. That's what their heart is in, helping people, advising people, you know, doing portfolio management because it's sort of the way that you learn, you know, what it's what they were doing, but that's really not what they want to be doing. That it is scary to make this transition, but it's not as hard as you think. It is very rewarding. The clients do understand. It's just, you know, you are your worst enemy in making this decision because you can be very successful at it. And if you've been successful prior to that, doing whatever model it was that you were doing, you're going to be successful doing this hourly model. Okay, if you were not successful doing whatever it was you were doing before, like AUM or commission, if you just weren't, then this is going to be a tough model for you too, because you probably weren't very good at marketing. You know, you probably may be very, very good at what you do, but you're not good at bringing in clients. And if you're good at bringing in clients and good at marketing, you're gonna be good no matter what model, fee model you use. You're gonna be successful. And that's really the key there. So if you've been successful as an AUM advisor, you're going to be successful as an hourly advisor. You will. It's just a scary move to make. But if you really feel your heart is into it, you know, if you actually do it, a couple of years later, you're going to say, I don't know why I didn't do this years ago.
So how can people contact you?
RickFerry.com. That's my website. And I answer all emails. And if it's an advisor who just wants to talk, I just basically say, oh, let's have a conversation. Yeah. Now, I also have an advisor consulting business. It's not very big, but I was talking about Ken Carbow from Liberty. I've got like four or five different advisory firms that advise to, and financial planners that I advise to. So, but you know, again, I just charge the same hourly fee as I charge for clients. But most of the time, I'll speak with an advisor first conversation. I don't know how long. Sometimes, you know, we get into these conversations like you and I are talking. I mean, this could be one of those conversations where you're an advisor and just asking me questions and I freely give you my advice, you know, pro bono, what I think. And then, you know, that send you on your way. But if you want me to do more than that, you know, do some sort of a coaching, then it gets into a contract or an engagement letter and I start charging for my time. But right. I've always been freely giving advice, whether people want it or not, as you probably saw on Twitter.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for mentioning that because I feel that there's a lack of good guidance about how to transition to the hourly model. I mean, I know that there are some advisors doing it, but there's all this resistance to it. So I'm really glad that you're out there to support people who do want to do it. And I'm hoping that this podcast will inspire people to consider it that prior to were kind of blocking it off in their minds. So thank you so much for being here, Rick. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Sarah. Appreciate you having me on.
Great. Okay, everybody. So that's it for now. I will see you in the next one. And please rate, review, and subscribe to this show.